A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Hi, I'm Sarah Smith. If you're the type of person that goes to Liberty as other people would go on safari, and the fact that John Lewis doesn't have a funeral service makes you fret, Sarah Smith cleaning cloths are for you. Sarah Smith, available from Sainsbury's, for the posher washer. Proud sponsors of Dumpty Dum.
Hello? Hello? Is there anyone there? Hello, is that Ambridge? Hello? Oh, blimmin' heck. Sorry, Vicky, love.
I don't mind admitting, gents, that this show has given me, I'm not going to quite say sleepless nights, but after blithely saying on the show we're going to do Man's Hour, I didn't know what the hell we were going to do, but this is going to work out. And if it doesn't, I'm going to blame all of you. This is Dumdy Dum, the show, but the reality docudrama that is centred on Ambridge in the heart of the Midlands. I'm the handsome and noble brother that is Royfield Brown. With me, I have the feckless and shifty siblings that are...
Yokel Bear and...
Andrew Horn.
And with us this week in the house, we have the big, bad Mike Tucker Milkman, who's sometimes known also as...
Terry Malloy.
And the last part of our Mandire folks is you. Now, lurking in the background, we also have a very clever and funny person from Twitter called Jed, who's going to be doing something rather special for us later on. Today's Dumpty Dum is from Terry Malloy, a.k.a. Mikey T of the show. Now, Yokel Bear, if somebody would like to send us a Dumpty Dum, how can they do that?
If you'd like to sing us a Dumpty Dum or play it on the spoons, whatever, or give us a plot prediction, then ring us on 0203 031 3105 or leave us a message on SpeakPipe. Thanks to the lovely Lucy for going away. Hope she's having a lovely time so that myself and Andrew can once again co-host this amazing podcast. Also, thanks to Cosmo for his podcast roundups. And to Sarah Smith for sponsoring us.
On this week's episode, we have a bumper crop of calls from Catherine Rowan-Jones, reminiscing on Games at the Fate, Vicky Cole, who is chilled by Rob, Catherine Kavanagh on Shula, Lizzie and the Doc Lock Triangle, Christina Auckland, who believes Charlie Thomas holds the key, Claire from Clapham, who hears echoes in the Pip Toby story, Andrea Melling, who wants to know when George was sent away to public school, Morgan Johnson, who fears Joe is booking a one-way ticket. Maeve with a message for Jill. Steve, who thinks Helen is doomed. And Dusty Substances, who wants it all to stop. But first, let's have Jed's Week in Ambridge.
We started on the cricket field, where Harrison Burns was having trouble with some nasty balls. I don't understand that, Esther, said Burnsy. I read all those books you gave me, and they don't seem to have worked. I'm not sure Dr. Seuss is a qualified sports psychologist. I do not like those nasty balls. I do not like those balls at all. I do not like them at me shin. I do not like them on me chin. Those nasty balls are hard to hit. It's that, or just me battings. At that point, the serpent of Gaslight Cottage butted in to hiss into Harassment's ear and convince him to get under Darrington's skin. Not everyone round here can shed their skin, like Rob. Ambridge came away with a win. Our snaky friend celebrated by slithering around Fallon's buns and invited the whole team to the pub where he'd buy them all drinks. They all declined, knowing snakes aren't renowned for putting their hands in their pockets, or having hands, or pockets. Eventually, he just hissed venom at Adam and rustled off into the undergrowth. Joe Grundy's predicting doom, gloom, Burnham Wood coming to Dunsinane in Surrey, Grange Farm, and the rising of the waters, whereby the farm that was being overflowed shall perish. Elfsworld's residents have listened to his prophecies and are all piling into their little elf boats and fleeing for a better life downstream in Felpersham. Back at Gaslight, the snake hissed instructions to Emma about keeping Henry sterile at all times. He brushed away Emma's help at zipping him into his bubble, and off he bounced down the lane, startling a slightly confused Patrick McGowan. St. Shula, I knew her before she was a virgin, you know, moped into the bull for her birthday party, the highlight of which was Jill hooting, "A sat-nav!" like Lady Bracknell, before spotting Liz, ditching her sainted daughter and denying her three times before cockcrow. At least with a sat-nav, when she tells Alistair where to go, she can give him accurate directions. At the first horse painting, you can piss off. Linda's taken to impersonating Paris Hilton as carrying her dog round in a handbag. She had jolly tales of the funeral, but I'm rather disturbed by the question of, will he come again? No stone stands over where he lies. The same could be said for Stefan in his culvert. Don't know about you, but I reckon that Resurgam stone has powers, and Ambridge will soon fill with legions of the shambling undead. Or is that just Dante Cardboard heading for the shop? Doc Locke was cornered by Shula. She sighed, moaned, and wove herself a natty crown of thorns from a nearby bramble bush. All of his advice to her seemed to come from his favourite films. He told her to always let her conscience be her guide. Paint with all the colours of the wind. Look for the bare necessities. Whistle while you work. And Hakuna Matata. After a detour to liberate Chris Carter's prop from the passion play, Shula wandered across the village, only pausing to tell Linda not to lay Scruff to rest on the consecrated ground. Big mistake, Shula. Big mistake. Wedging her cross into the living room, Shula confessed her guilt and lay herself at the feet of Anna Toboggan, to be told, "That's nice, dear. Now bugger off before your stigmata keeps dripping on my rug." Down in Hampshire, the snake hissed a cheery hello to Jess before slithering off to Arsula's with the bubble boy bouncing along behind. The fair buttocks were waffling on about Toby's fictional weekend away with Dapper Dog, Monty, Jaunty, Happy, Sneezy, Dopey, Grumpy, Bashful, when the phone rang. Lizzie's old bit of stuff, Robin, was ill and needed some attention. Toby suggested hiring a nurse from a carry-on film, leaving him free to roll in the hay with Pip. But Rex decided to drop everything, put on his Florence Nightingale costume and run off to see Jill, who for some reason was running around with a sheet over her head, pretending to be a ghost. Carol Toboggan was talking rubbish and seemed to be fixated on food on Friday morning. Anna asked for a bag of herbs. Then Carol disappeared off to see Jill, who told her to grab a smoker and come along. Not sure what they're up to at those hives. I'm sure they're getting a buzz out of it. So as we leave Ambridge for this week, Joe's waters are rising, the woods are walking, Scruff is resurgamming on Linda's mantelpiece, Shula's off up Lakey Hill to find somewhere nice to put her cross, the Fairbrother curse is casting its spell on a third generation of archers, and the serpent is spreading his poison across the county. So business as usual, then. The end.
Oh, hey! Bravo, well, sir. Bravo. Who needs Lucy?
Oh, that was lovely.
Well done, mate. Well done.
Thank you.
You couldn't have a Manzow on Dum-de-Dum without having Mr. Alpha Male himself, Mr. Terry Malloy, a.k.a. the Milkman. Mr. Malloy.
Yeah.
This is all about us men this week, right? Yeah. And we decided, well, you know, we had to come to you, very obviously. Now, you weren't the milk person, were you? You were the milkman.
I was the milkman. Oh, God, yeah.
But, you know...
Definitely the milkman and the cowman and the manager.
And you were Betty's man.
And I was Betty's man.
Well, I always thought that you pair were actually a very good team, really. But you were a bit of a bastard at the start to it, though, weren't you?
Mike was total unreconstituted male. You know, a woman's place was in the home and, you know, that was it. He was certainly not one of the new men until...
Till he lost his eye.
Till he lost his eye, yeah.
Now, I always wondered, why did you never play in the cricket team?
Do you know, I can't think. Possibly because I'd only got one eye.
You didn't always have one eye, though, did you?
Oh, no, not to begin with. But he played in the darts team. I don't know why he never played in the cricket team.
Do you not need depth of field to play darts? Do you not need a depth of field? Don't you need your other eye to play to play darts? I suppose you don't. Where's your do with cricket? You need to know exactly where that ball's coming towards you.
No. You watch, you know, darts matches. You know, they put away so much alcohol. I mean, depth of field means nothing. You know, you can do it blindfolded. You know. It's dead easy. No, I don't know. I mean, it could be to do with the wooden leg. They didn't mention the wooden leg, did they?
Not much. Now, I've always wondered, right, you and Neil always seem to have a bit of a special relationship. Now, yeah. I've always thought to myself, since watching Brokeback Mountain, right, Brokeback Lakey Hill, you and Neil, what do you reckon?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, we get down with the pigs, you know, and give them an hand, and we'd sort it all out, you know. Nothing like a bit of wrestling with a pig in the mud, you know. It's manly.
Manly indeed.
Sort of thing one does in the countryside, you know. It's to be encouraged, I think.
Mr. Yokel Bear.
Yes.
What was your kind of favourite Mike moment?
I think it's less kind of a favourite moment. What I love about Mike was the fact that there was no messing, basically. Mm. Everything was kind of just, you know, it was this or that. It was, you know, I don't know. You put me on the spot there. I can't think of any. Yes, you have.
As is my want, prime host.
He's absolutely right, though. He is. I mean, Mike is, you know, he's a horny-handed son of the soil, and he suffers fools with no gladness whatsoever. And he, you know, he opens his mouth to change feet regularly, but you know, he says what he thinks. You know, he's not got no side to him in that respect.
But you know what? I always thought though that Mike had the thing with the ladies, because didn't you go off salsa dancing, and that's how you pulled your second wife?
Yeah, but no, he did. You see, he did dancing with Betty. Mm. Betty and Mike were great ballroom dancers.
Oh yes.
Oh yeah. He was sort of persuaded to go off doing some dancing by En Famille, who said, you know, come on, stop moping around the house, get out and get your shoes on again. Yeah, I mean,
he didn't forget Betty rather quickly, didn't he? As soon as you got out and started dancing again, you got yourself a younger model from Birmingham. Well,
he got sucked into the web of lust that is Vicky, basically. She's just a lust bucket on legs, you know. But there was a moment when Mike was practicing his dancing, you might remember, with them up at Grange Farm, Caroline's husband.
Okay.
Do you not remember that
scene? With Oliver? No. Please remind me.
It was a great scene, and we enjoyed doing it so much. He wanted to do it again. He was caught in mid waltz dip or whatever with Oliver when he was practicing for, I can't remember what it was for now, but I do remember the scene where we were both, you know, clutching each other. And so, you know, there are manly things that happen on in Ambridge, you know. But ballroom dancing is but one.
On a scale of 10, Mr. Horn, how much are you regretting Terry's temporary removal from Ambridge?
I think we've lost a lot. We've talked on other weeks about losing the characters, losing the different accents and all the new replacement people sounding the same from central casting. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great shame that we've lost the Tuckers. We very, very rarely hear from Roy these days either. Only one, just that last bit where he rode to Phoebe's rescue and saved her from her mad mother and aunt and all the gin drinking and whisked her off. But we don't have enough of Roy either, so no, it is a shame.
I'm going to put this to all of you gentlemen here. Very obviously, this thing that we've either worked in or produced podcasts for or just listened to is, let's be honest about it, primarily not aimed at us. It's aimed at women. It is, even though I call it a docudrama, it is in effect a soap opera. The term soap opera was coined in the 50s because the soap bit denoted selling soap powder for women who were at home, and this was something to market to them. And this is my kind of assertion. This is as serious as I'm going to get here. Do we believe that for the most part, the male characters are slightly underserved in terms of character depth? I'm going to throw that out to whoever wants to answer first.
No, I don't think so. It's Yokel Bear here. I've been thinking about this because a lot of people have said to me, Ambridge is all about the women. And it is, to a certain extent, well, to quite a large extent. But I think the really interesting thing about the men in Ambridge over the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, are seeing how the roles have changed. So you look at Brian. Brian's very much kind of 1950s old school. Where's my dinner? Why haven't you, do my washing for me? And then as you get to the newer generations, you see the men do things in a slightly different way. They're less kind of stereotypical. That's why I thought someone like Charlie was really interesting, because he was quite a manly man, but not stereotypically.
You thought Charlie was interesting for all sorts of reasons.
Well, I will admit that.
I was going with your with that so far along the way, but then thinking of the next generation, and David still isn't. So next generation on from Brian, David, he still pretty much relies on the central rock of a female character, usually his mother rather than his wife, to keep things going. And when Ruth buggered off to New Zealand, they were living on scraps until Jill came back. So I'd like to think they would become more sort of equal roles, but I'm struggling to think along the farming side where...
They've always been strong women there. And they are the bedrock of a lot of marriages. I mean, Mike, he wouldn't have been able to exist without Betty. And in fact, when she went, he fell apart because he didn't know what suit to wear, because she always chose stuff for him. Clary has always been that kind of mother courage figure in the heart of the Grundys. And although they lark around, when Clary puts a foot down, it happens. Those strong women have been there, and the men have kind of relied on them for the day-to-day stuff that they want. And I think it's part of the relationship of any marriage that you do find men, from my experience, relying on a woman, not just to provide food on the table, but to provide affirmation of what they're doing or countering things that they may be going off the rails on a bit and pulling them back. And women are mostly pretty much cleverer than men in that respect, I have to say. And I think Mike found that out, definitely, over the time he was with Betty and with Vicky. As much as the lust was there in the beginning, it's very much that Vicky called the shots as to a lot of the things that they did, and Mike sort of went along with it, May have moaned about it and grumbled about it. And Susan and Neil are the same, Susan says what she says, and like a lot of men, we go, oh, flipping wife, I better not say that, and off they go.
And it's the same down the younger generation. If you look at Harrison and Fallon, it's very much Fallon
let me just stop here, Mr. Horn. So after Yokel Bear saying he disagreed with me, you're all agreeing with me that actually the characters who are, and this is we're slightly going away from my point, because there is the dynamic between it within a relationship. But I would contend that the most compelling characters, the most in-depth, written in the most kind of in-depth, would be Jennifer, Lillian, Linda. And there is a link that, that invariably that they're all female. And generally, if we looked at Susan and Neil, in terms of the kind of the richness of that character in the way that they're written, Susan is richer than Neil. There's kind of no two ways about it. Linda is richly kind of portrayed much more than Robert. And I kind of could go on. What do you reckon, Jed? I know you're only lurking, but what do you reckon?
Sorry.
Nice to know that you're paying attention, sir.
You fell asleep.
I was sitting and listening quite happily. I wasn't formulating anything.
You thought you listened to the podcast, didn't you? You're on it for a change, sir.
I drifted off. I'm not in my garden for a change.
A quick thought, Jed. What do you reckon?
Well, yes, I find the female characters do tend to have a lot more about them. A lot of the blokes do tend to be slightly dozy stereotypes, I've found. Hopefully that'll sort itself out, but I don't know. It was your original point about it being a soap opera, so aimed maybe towards women. That's a hangover from those eras. I just don't know.
So with the exception of Terry, we're all a bit peculiar, the fact that we love this thing so much.
We do love it. But Royfield, I think a lot of those examples you're comparing within relationships as sort of male and female, but there are some fleshed out characters that are male. Jazza, everyone loves Jazza. He's you know what Jazza's going to do.
I love Jazza too, but Jazza's actually one note. Jazzer is a one-note character, I would say. Though I'm a big Jazzer fan, don't get me wrong.
So, okay, so what you're saying then is really then the men that are there are playing along one theme. So Jazzer, Jimmers in a similar vein. Uh-huh. So the one, of course, who is highly nuanced is Rob.
If malevolence and evil is nuanced. Go on, Yokel Bear.
Yeah, I've kind of changed my mind about it, actually. I've been persuaded by your arguments. But I think one interesting thing is that, yeah, the women are the kind of central and the strong people. But I think within the characters, the men don't see it like that. And one interesting thing that I picked up on was when you look at the two examples where men in the Archers have had real mental health problems, Daryl and Kenton, it all seemed to be sparked off by all of a sudden they couldn't fulfill the role that they saw for themselves as the provider, not bringing the money in, that kind of thing. And I think that kind of, in a strange way, we look at it from the outside, but from the character's point of view, I think the men would see themselves as the central part of Ambridge. But actually, you're right, you're probably not.
No, I mean, it's the same with Mike when he had his breakdown, you know. It was due to the fact that he'd lost the farm, he'd gone bankrupt, he'd lost an eye, he was incapable of providing for his family, and he went into depression and, you know, very nearly topped himself. And it was, you know, funnily enough, it was Cassie, another woman, who came and talked him down. Yeah, very much so. There is that, and you're right, it is, the men would assume that they're in command, as I think most men do in real life. They go along happily thinking, I'm in charge, I'm the breadwinner, I'm bringing it in, you know. They do compromise. They have to compromise for the sake of the relationship, and generally are happy to do so. But they would still see themselves as the head of the family. It's this old kind of saw that, you know, it's the, you know, the man is the head of the family, and all else, you know, fades into insignificance.
But let's be honest as well. If Brian was suddenly single, he'd probably starve to death in a week, wouldn't he?
He would. Yeah.
Now he'd just go and eat down at Grey Gables every day, wouldn't he? And the bull.
That's probably true. Yeah.
But there is one area which is forever kind of mandem in Ambridge, and that is the Ambridge cricket team. So how do we feel about the demise?
They're all getting in on it now. You know, you've got Fallon doing tees. You've got, you know, the women's cricket team when they come, or the women's, when they have the single wicket, they're shown to be rather good at playing cricket. You know, the only true male preserve is still the cider club.
No. Lillian's joined.
Yes, she did. Yes.
I missed that one.
Crumbs.
Ambridge, I don't know what's happening.
Gentlemen, there is nothing left for us at all.
Where this is going with the cricket is they're going to keep losing matches, and eventually somebody's going to say, why don't we try a woman in? And I think that's where that's going. With Lillian, Lillian, I think it's not so much kind of, if you like, the feminization of the cider club. I think it's just because Lillian can smell alcohol at 200 paces.
Yeah, and she can be one of the boys, can't she? When she
absolutely.
I'm just going to say, I mean, are you sure Lillian is a lady? I mean, I wouldn't like to be wrong. Which throws a whole new light. Justin relationship.
Yeah, Justin seems to think that she is, so...
Well,
gentlemen, at that point, I think we should actually throw the show out to our caller-inners.
Hello, Ambridge 3962.
Catherine Rowan-Jones is first.
Hello, good evening, Dumpty Dummers everywhere. It's Catherine Rowan-Jones, the euphoniously named Ravelry volunteer summariser from High Wycombe. Thank you very much for your kind words about my name, Royfield, and Lucy B. Freeman for calling me a super listener. I've been doing some more super listening, and in the last show, Royfield said that Doc Locke had mentioned you don't know what goes on inside marriages, and that's quite right. But he wasn't talking to Alistair. He was talking to Elizabeth. He treated her to lunch after she helped him choose the birthday brooch for Shula. So I just wanted to clear that up, because I might be wrong, but I think there's a bit of bristling going on between Alistair and Doc Locke. And I wanted to say that I was listening to Test Match Special today, Pakistan against England at the Oval, and it went surreally Archers. There was a bowler ranging in called Iftikhar, sadly not Lizzie's former love interest. And at one point, Tuffers was explaining lovingly and at great length to a younger commentator about the pleasures of whack-a-mole that he used to experience at the fun fair or at the seaside, and explained very carefully his version of whack-a-mole is when the creature pops up through random holes in a baseboard and you have to try and strike it rather than descending a vertical tube like a downpipe, which I know is Splat the Rat. So thank you very much for the show. I love listening. I've been a listener from the very beginning, long-time lurker, recent caller-innerer, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing Dumpty Dum Men's Hour. Curious what you're going to talk about. The men I know tend to talk about problems with their cars, which curiously doesn't seem to happen on the Archers.
Now, Catherine was reminiscing about games at the Fete. Now, Mr. Horn, you seem to be from Middle England, somewhere which I'm from the middle of England, but not from Middle England. Whack-a-mole, dunk the vicar. This is not my wheelhouse, this.
I did get picked up by, I think it was really? By Derek the other day. And I got confused. I confused whack-a-mole with Splat the Rat. And yes, I do remember both of those at Village Fates. But I think she was also talking about the Lizzie and Alistair, Dockie Lockie's conversation with Lizzie and not Alistair, mm-hmm. about what goes on in a marriage.
Can I just quickly jump in? Yes, everybody, I misspoke when I said it was Dockie Lockie and Alistair that had that conversation. Thank you for correcting me on every manner of social media going, everybody, for saying it was actually Dockie Lockie and Elizabeth. But yeah, go on.
And Catherine's other point that she was making is that men, and this is really in relation with Man's Hour, mm-hmm. men talk about problems with their cars, she finds, in general life, but not in the Archers. And I was reflecting on that after listening to the call, and I think, I mean, apart from Jim's Riley, we don't really know what people drive. And
well,
I suppose
Tony
that's...
and his MG. Tony had still got his MG, hasn't he?
Yeah, he did rebuild the MG, but I suppose it's principally because they don't want to get into sort of brand endorsement or mm-hmm. things like that. And didn't Woolley have Jack Woolley have a Bentley or something that he had?
He did. He had something, didn't he?
Yeah. He used to send the gardener around in. Mm. Mm. But cars are generally not discussed.
No, I'm sat here and I'm still pondering over the Village Fete thing. I feel as though I've missed out somewhere, because we never had anything like whack-a-mole at Village Fates down here. We always had a tombola, which if you've ever listened to My Dad Wrote a Porno, that's enough to put you off tombolas for life.
Indeed, that's a Monday morning treat.
I mean, it's the West Country. Down here, we just do a wicker man. I mean, that's kind of how fates roll down here.
But you presumably have sort of triple Morris men instead or something.
Oh, you can't move for Morris men. Tell you what, down here, just anything you put on. Sometimes they turn up without even being asked. They're just there. The Morris men turn up. But I quite like Morris dancing. I wouldn't do it myself, but I quite like it. I think it's I think it gets a bad press.
I don't know. I think it gets a press it deserves. When you think of indigenous kind of dances around the world and Brazil and its samba and the half-naked beautiful people shaking their bits to that, or some kind of African tribal routines and whatever, and you have, here's England's example, Morris dancing with men in handkerchiefs and bells. Oh, come on. It doesn't stand up.
The thing is, with bells on their ankles, you can hear them coming and make your escape.
Very
unless
true.
They turn off your app and you're doomed.
I tell you, we used to have a thing called Lucas's Sports, which used to happen once a year down the road from where I used to live in Perry Bar in Birmingham. And I'm kind of realising what a big deal this was. Because this maybe stopped when I was about 8 or so. Because Lucas's closed down in Birmingham. But we had the Red Devils, you know, flying above head. None of this whack-a-mole nonsense. This was a, you know, even for the 70s, this was a big deal. So this whack-a-mole Dunk the Vicar is just not a world I know anything about.
Know nothing about it myself.
Anyway, so Vicky Cole wants to move on from things of village fatedom, and she wants to talk about being chilled by Rob.
Hello everyone, this is Vicky Cole in Kenya. I'm now back in Kenya after 2 months away in the UK. So back to the land of power cuts and a sick chicken and no elderflower cordial. First of all, can I say how lovely it was to hear from Christine last week? I really enjoy the Ambridge Observer, so it was great to have an insight into that. So thank you for inviting her. And secondly, I'd like to say cheers to Tim Watson. Absolutely brilliant acting. I think every single thing that Rob has said this week has been chilling, just brilliantly acted. I'm gathering from all the various forums and Facebook pages and discussion pages that legally it's all getting a bit silly now and, you know, a bit unrealistic. But it's still jolly good drama to listen to, very exciting. And I have no plot prediction. I don't know what's going to happen, whether it will be Jess who saves the day or Emma. But at the moment I'm leaning towards Emma a bit because Rob is just being so absolutely horrible to her. I think she's not going to have any sense of misplaced loyalty to him. So we shall see. I'm travelling quite a lot round the time that the trial is, so thank goodness for podcasts. Okay, good luck with your boys' podcast. Bye.
Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, gentlemen, how chilled are we by Mr. Titchener? Over to you, Mr. Yokel Bear.
This week, about 27.
Hmm.
There was the bit where there was a bit, just the bit with the venom that he kind of said to Emma. I'm sure you've spent the money already, but without giving anything away, I did listen to the Sunday episode. Just
No.
And let's just say it doesn't let up. It's just like, you know, it's just this week he's really showing his true colours, isn't it? Just that he can't help himself. Mm. It's just, and I think what it is that whole thing, I think it all started, the real ratcheting up of it, when he's realised, when he was asking people to go down the pub, that he's got no support.
Mm.
I think he's backed into a corner.
Yes, I mean, I think that Sunday's episode I really enjoyed with the, I'm talking about last Sunday, with the cricket, but his whole approach starting to mend fences and you could sense, or I sort of sense, you're putting this on. You're going out of your way to try and build or rebuild a sort of a base around you with the trial coming up. I thought it was very calculated. But then after the game, he was trying to get them all down to the pub, and one by one they made their excuses and left, in the words of the famous Sun journalist. Mm. And then he started getting needle and started picking on people, and when Adam actually said, "I'm not coming because Ian is a character witness," which is the wrong thing to say because that's now tipped him off that Ian is going to be a character witness. He then turned on him, and so the veneer is very shallow at the moment. He's coming across as strong and as very chilling, and his performance this week amazing. He just turns it on a sixpence, and lots of the callers pick up on that, but yeah. on the other hand, he's close to breaking. You know, when Henry's kicking the back of his seat in the car, and yep, I know with Alex, it's really, really infuriating my little boy if he does that. But he just like, boom, you know, sort of bit his head off, and then he just then switches it back on. When he went, oh look, here comes Daddy's friend. Da da. Yeah. It's a masterful performance.
It is absolutely a masterful performance, and it's one of the issues that, when I did think of this whole kind of man's hour thing, I thought to myself, we really should spend a little bit of time not only on Rob, but on the wider issues that the introduction of Rob has brought to the village, i.e. kind of coercive control. And just very quickly, gents, the whole idea of kind of coercive control within a relationship has been something which obviously the Archers has massively highlighted, and the legislation around it is still actually relatively new. Kind of at what point in the whole Rob and Helen storyline were you truly aware that there was something malevolent going on? I kind of missed the tuna bake thing when that first happened, which I think was when a lot of the female listeners thought, this guy is absolutely wrong. And I just thought he was a blokesy bloke, to be honest with you. So if I just quickly just go round the table, so to speak, the virtual table, starting with you, Jed, when did you first pick up that Rob was truly the Dark Lord?
I've never been that sure of him, but when the penny finally dropped, I think was when Helen went out and got the new dress. And he just went, oh, no, that's far too tarty. Can't wear that. Got to wear this sheet over you before you go to the party. It was at that point I thought, oh, hang on. No, this guy's a wrong'un.
How about you, Yokel Bear?
Do you know, I can't pinpoint an exact moment. And I think that's been the strength of the script writing, is the fact that it's just kind of built. The tension and the plot has just built very, very slowly, tiny little bits. I think whether this was kind of clocking him for what he was fully, but I think the kind of the background, the kind of homophobia that he's shown towards Adam and Ian. I mean, like, there was another example this week where he said, your so-called husband and you people. But I think also, like Jed, I think the dress was the one where the penny really dropped of, there isn't any doubt anymore. This is what this guy is.
Mm. How about you, Mr. Horn?
Well, I came to it rather late. Like Jed, I wasn't quite sure whether he was just an old-fashioned chap. And even with the dress, whilst it was, was obviously wrong, it might just have been his, you know, I'm very protective. I've got my girl now, and I don't want anyone else to see. I want it to be sort of covered up. And I put up a thread, and I think it might even have been last October, which got quite a lot of talk coming, where I would even, you know, try to say, is it as a result of his child and his relationship with his mother? Can't remember quite when, but I know since talking to obviously Goddess Steve got it straight away, and there must be some sort of dog whistle signals that got to her, but talking to Catherine Kavanagh, you know, she said it got the hairs on the back of her neck from really, really quite early days. And I can't remember, there's a couple of examples that she gave me when we were talking about it, that was just, and you are, it just shows you are tuned into different signals. So for a long time, I thought he was being written and played in an ambiguous way. And there was always, you could see two sides. So really, I came to it really quite late, and that is one of the great things about this family and this community. I learn a lot from Goddess Diva, things that I've not really been exposed to, and so it's all great from that point of view. But no, I missed it. I'll stick my hand up to that.
That's really interesting, because I was going to say about Goddess Diva, because I've had conversations with her early on in this plot where I've said, look, are we absolutely sure that this is kind of coercion? Is that, you know, because it seemed ambiguous in the plot. And she was saying to me, absolutely 100% definite, this is where this is going. And I know a lot of other women that said far earlier than men, this is where it's going. And I think, it made me think about kind of, well, how do I look at things like this? Am I not picking up on stuff? So, yeah, that was really interesting.
No, and I think you absolutely nailed it, Andrew, is that, you hear kind of slightly different things, you know, depending on the gender bias or your sexual bias, etc., etc. But for me, where this falls down massively is the amount of work that the scriptwriters have done, obviously, to outlay this whole issue of coercive control, and to do it in such a masterful way that not everybody got it at first. It's not just men, but a lot of men didn't get it for some time because it was so insidious, it was so subtle. And then it's well documented what I think about the actual stabbing. But for me, it's been spoilt by the fact we now have a procedural. We have a court crime procedural now where people are saying, well, wait on a minute. Is Anna Tregaron, is she a barrister? Is she a solicitor? This wouldn't happen, that wouldn't happen, etc., etc. That the power of this storyline is actually now being dissipated massively by, I think, the wrong move of having Helen actually stab him. And I'm absolutely no legal expert. I'm hardly a podcaster. You know, I'm still barely an Archer's listener of any kind of standing after 35 years. But it appears to me that whatever Anna can dredge up, the prima facie, there isn't much of a case against Rob, really. You know, he's been stabbed. You know, if I put all the character stuff kind of to one side, well, if I think about that, for the most part, it is kind of hearsay. But surely what we're witnessing now is just the unravelling of Rob, and that Rob is actually going to blow his case up is what I think is going to happen.
I think Rob is going to blow his own case. I think that's the thing. And I've been very frustrated about... But I don't know how real this is, you see. I don't know... The whole thing with Helen kind of holding back the way she is. I'm guessing that's kind of how that will play out in real life.
I'm guessing... quickly, Jacob, I'm guessing that this bit, as frustrating as it is for us, the listeners, probably does play out, because I do believe that in terms of the psychology of the abused, the script writers have gone to meticulous amount of detail. So I'm sure this is actually quite standard. It's frustrating for us, the listeners, but it plays as being somewhat kind of true to life. But if you're going to go to this much detail, you've got to at least have a solicitor being a solicitor. You know, there isn't one. Barrister being a barrister. You can't really have it both ways. And this is where the storyline has actually been muddied. The power of the storyline has been muddied. Because if they've gone to this amount of research, they will know that in the vast, vast, vast majority of these types of horrible cases, there isn't an attempted murder. That what happens is there is some kind of crisis point, then that woman leaves. The truth of the matter is that she comes back numerous times, and that would have made for great drama in terms of the village, where, you know, why is Helen back at Bridge Farm, etc., etc., and then, you know, Henry being bounced from here to there and still loving Daddy, etc. But it'd be much more powerful, and then we wouldn't have people like Miss Mid-City saying, actually, you know, legally, this is all bunkum, you know, because we've all been swept along by the power of this storyline, which is just written so well. And I just think they've just so spoilt it by saying, oh, now there's going to be a trial and Helen's behind bars, and then there's Kaz with a Croydon, you know, facelift, etc., etc. And
Do you think, though, that there's... I mean, for a start, one thing I say is, no wonder Anna sounds so knackered. She's doing, like, three jobs, isn't she? But do you think that the reason they've done it this way, and I know a lot of the legal people that listen have been tearing their hair out, going, this is so not the way it would happen. But do you think that they've done this simply not to introduce multiple new characters? They've tried to condense it down to just one character dealing with this, just for the expediency of not having to bring in loads and loads of people.
I think that's on record, isn't it?
Yeah, no.
They couldn't afford to have a solicitor and a barrister and invest in the development of those characters. So they've sort of lumped it all on Anna.
But if you go back to the stabbing, which was incredibly dramatic. You could have literally had that scene apart from the actual stabbing, and it could have cut before you knew what would happened, and then in Archer's fashion, the next scene is Helen at Bridge Farm sobbing her eyes out, which would have created the same amount of press, because ultimately this is all a ratings game, isn't it? And it got on the front page of the Daily Mail. We cannot forget how powerful that kind of episode was. The episode could have been played the same way, and with him saying, go get that knife then, or whatever the heck Rob actually said, and then it could have cut, and you could have gone, oh my God, what happened? And then the next episode, her sobbing, and Pat saying, Helen, what's the matter, what's the matter? Mm-hmm. And that would have served the storyline really, really well, and given a much more realistic and instructive lesson on kind of coercive control. And then you just had this incredibly compelling, I would have said, a much more believable to-ing and fro-ing for the next 18 months where Rob is trying to woo her, but then everybody knows what kind of a shit he is, you know, straight away. But anyway, I ain't going to say any more about this, because Catherine Kavanagh wants to talk about Shula, Lizzie, and the Docky Locky love triangle.
Hello, everyone. Hello, boys. I know it's the boys' episode this week. This is Catherine Kavanagh here, at Kavanagh CK on the Twitter. I want to say a special hello to my two favourite Twitter men, one being my wonderful brother in rugby, Steve Parrott, and the second being my brother in music, Andrew Horn. Andrew and I, looking forward to singing together Mozart's Mass in C minor in St Bride's in October of this year, so that's a big plug for them. To matters this week, and specifically I think the scriptwriters deserve a big shout out, because how they have managed to make that man so utterly malevolent in even the simplest of delivery. The comment this evening to Emma about, you've probably spent it already, or the comment to Jess about, oh, where does he get his blue eyes from? Are they from his father? What a fuck. Sorry for my French, apologies. I genuinely think the acting is superb, out of this world, and Tim Watson really deserves any accolade that's due to him. To matters female, poor old Shula. I do feel sorry for her. I know I'm the first and only person to say that, but she clearly is married to a fella who's only concerned about himself, doesn't give a shit about her. And the present from Dr. Dickie Tricky, clearly was a chance for him to ingratiate himself with her awful bloody sister. So poor old Shula, spare a thought for a lady who probably is going through some angst. I know she's only fictional. I know it's all only fictional, but God, I love it. Hope you're all very well, boys. I enjoy interacting with all of you on Twitter. I think this is a lovely idea from Royfield. Royfield, hope you're doing well stateside. And well bloody done to my friend Harriet on the past 2 weeks. And Millie, I will send you a separate speak pipe because you made me laugh and laugh last week inadvertently.
I must admit, I'm somewhat not quite invested in this love triangle, gentlemen. So I'm going to leave this over to you, Mr. Andrew Horn. Tell us what you think.
Well, first of all, Catherine, thanks for the plug for the Mozart. Looking forward to starting to sing that with you next week, this week. But I think, Royfield, when you say you're not yet invested in the love triangle, you're not invested. I think it's you're not yet invested. I think it's going to be one of those stories that in the run-up to Christmas will come back.
I think you're spot on the money, sir. And I say this all the time, that you know, you settle down with the characters that you know and the dynamic that you know, and you kind of like that, and new things get introduced, and for the most part, this is going, oh, you know, it is another thing, and then you do end up getting swept along with it. So you are right, but back over to you, Mr.
Yes,
Hayes.
So I think the absolutely right. The whole point of it is talking about the present that he's bought for Shula was more trying to ingratiate himself with Lizzie. I agree. I agree with Catherine there, and I think also the someone else, and I can't quite see it in my notes at the moment, picked up on the fact that the, you know, Shula asked Docky for his opinion on her road to crucifixion, and he gave her several pointers which he then ignored or took the wrong way. I mean, he is not interested in Shula at all in that way. That is all water that's under the bridge, and I think he's quite clear. I wouldn't say he's actively pursuing Lizzie, but that's where he knows that Shula and Alistair are together. He didn't split them up last time round, and he's not trying to split them up now.
Mm.
Ooh. Is that dissent, Yoko Bear?
Well, I just... The problem with this storyline, this is probably says more about me than anything else, is that I've tried to get invested in this storyline, and I just can't. And I can't for one simple reason, which is that I really can't stand Shula. So anytime Shula does anything, I'm like, yeah, whatever. And just, so I don't know. I think the thing, out of all of them... You know, in that love triangle, if that's what it is, I think Doc Locke is the most likable out of them. I think Doc Locke's quite a straightforward guy. Alistair, got no idea what he's up to because... Well,
that's the key to everything, really, isn't it? Because Doc Locke obviously has a little bit of a thing for Lizzie and Lizzie likes him. Mm. And the whole thing with the present somewhat is going to... is there to confuse Shula into thinking that there's a little something going on in terms of Doc Locke having affection for her. But actually, the key to all of this is what the hell is going on with Shula and Alistair's marriage, which is more to do with Alistair's apparent kind of ambivalence to the whole thing and neglect of the whole thing. So they've got into some kind of rut, but there is something going on with Alistair horse paintings. There is something going on with Alistair not even caring that Rob forced Shula to lie to the police. Not one point did he say, "The bastard, how dare he? You know, how did you feel about that?" You know, so, and Alistair has always been written as somewhat of a sympathetic character, you know, even to a degree round the whole kind of gambling thing, you know, you had a certain amount of sympathy for him because you just thought, you're with that woman, you need a release somehow, you know, so but in this regard, no, you know, so I think me personally, I'll become much more kind of invested and much more interested in this whole kind of storyline when I truly find out what's going on with Alistair, because I think the script writers have got something quite juicy lined up for us.
Well, me and Goddess Diva have a theory, but it's...
Oh, go.
go.
Is it one that which we could, you can outlay on a family podcast, Yokel Bear?
Kind of.
Go on, then.
Shall I give it a go? And
go on.
You can edit it out. I was having a conversation with Goddess Diva and we were talking about Alistair and what have you. Said, well, he's always popping out of an evening. Mm-hmm. And then we just kind of looked at each other and said, you don't suppose he's going dogging? But the thing with... just go aside from the jokes. Do you think this week there was an interesting bit? You know, when Alistair was having the chat with Shula, she was on the horse and all that kind of thing, where he quite aggressively grabbed the bridle. I think I got a sense that he's frustrated with Shula, probably wider than just that one conversation. He seems to be quite frustrated and pissed off with her. I just want a sense I get.
Well, it's not the first time that she's sort of got her hair shirt out and, you know, this is a sort of recurring theme over their marriage, isn't it, with her... falling out with the church and all various other things along the way. I can't call them to mind, but when she goes into this, it's typical Shula reaction, isn't it? It's sort of, woe is me, I am not worthy sort of thing. So I'm not surprised he's getting a bit fed up. And I think Maeve comes back to that later on in her call as well.
Well, you know what, Andrew?
Sorry?
I think we should go straight on to Maeve's call now.
Yes, let's go to Maeve, because then we get the two lovely Irish voices together.
Hello, Dumpty Dum. This is Maeve, ringing from the big press. Gosh, haven't been sort of listening too much of late. I've just been back and forth to Ireland, looking after my elderly mum, sorting out my sodding children, all the shite and detritus of 51-year-old's life, really. So listen to the omnibus this morning, and a few things. First of all, Jill, just keep your feckin' nose out of your granddaughter's love life. It's none of your business. You know, mind your beeswax. Just let Pip get on with it. I hate Pip. I do hate her. I really hate her. But you know what? Just get on with it, Pip. Chances are, Is she going to get pregnant? Don't know. Don't think she'd be that stupid. But I think what's going to happen is Toby's actually really going to fall for her and fall hard for her. And there's going to be some kind of a Pip kind of love angsty thing in a couple of months, which will just bore the arse off everybody. Shula. Oh my God, Shula. You know what, Shula? Come on, you're such a martyr. You know, just climb back up there on your crucifix, you know, because actually, you know, just get over it. You lied. Or you didn't actually tell the truth, and now it's come back to bite you on the arse. And what I would say is to Alistair, go now, Alistair, while you still can, while you still have breath in your body. There is a better horse, donkey, sheep out there for you. Just go. And I, you know what? And I thought Anna had it spot on, because when Shula came up expecting Anna to go, oh my God, you're so fantastic, you're going to put your own liberty on the line. I don't know why I'm doing that in an American accent. Anyway, whatever. But she didn't. She went, yeah, you are a liar, and yeah, you are a coward, and yeah, you know what, it doesn't matter, so you could just f*** off. So Shula, you know, you've got your comeuppance, which I'm really, really, really pleased about. And creepy Rod, eh? Rob, eh? Ooh. I thought that scene was really, really, really well played. Although, Jesus Christ, why can't they get, you know, a better voice for f***ing Henry? I mean, how old is he now?
Well, I was pulling Catherine's leg earlier about having listened to her call with a couple of right words in, and my 7-year-old boy was in the room at the time. Luckily, he had his headphones on, so he didn't hear. And then I did tweet her back later and say, you've lost the award for sweary Irish woman of the week with Maeve. But I just love it with both of them. It's softened by the accent. And Maeve's absolutely right that Jill should just butt out and let Pip get on with it. I want to come back at some stage and explore Yokel Bear's theory of the ancient curse of the Fair Brothers, which we had on Twitter today. But with Maeve, yeah, absolutely. So Jill should just butt out. And she has great sympathy for Alistair.
Oh, no, come on. I think that's a bit harsh. I think if you've heard Rex rip into his brother the way that Jill has, and with the evidence of her own eyes, forget the Toby, you know, coming out of Pip's cottage at 3 a.m. in the morning. Put that to one side. Okay. But the fact that Rex just says, you know what, my brother is feckless, and here are the reasons why, you know, doesn't care about his father, doesn't care, you know, if that was my granddaughter, I'm at least going to have a roundabout conversation as well. Because the thing is, Toby is a bit of a sh-, let's be quite honest about it. He's not a bad person. He's not evil. But, you know, would you be actively encouraging, or would you necessarily turn a blind eye to your granddaughter carrying on with such a person? I might well have that conversation that Jill had, taking the curse of the Fair Brothers completely to one side. Because what Rex said was pretty powerful, pretty compelling, and pretty spot on the money.
But I don't think that's where... I think what's driving it from Jill's point of view is the curse of the Fair Brothers.
It is.
And I think, I mean, I must say, Jojo also got onto this afternoon on the Twitters. I'm not sure. I wouldn't have had a conversation with as frank as that with my grandmother. I'm not sure I've had a conversation as frank as that with my parents. Mm. But I am a bit of a Pip fan, and I'm quite
good heavens.
I like the way that
good
she
heavens, man.
Is.
Can you just repeat that again? I think people might have misheard you. Just say what you just said again.
So I am quite a Pip fan.
Let's move on. Jed. Jed,
that's
can you bring
harsh,
some
Roy.
Sanity back to this podcast, please? We've just lost a whole load of listeners. Bring it back, Jed.
No, Pip has grated on me for so long. The robot milkers saga and all her telling daddy out of farm just annoyed me. But I think she's going to get to Toby. You turn up when I say, you do what I say, and then go on, sod off, I'll call you when I need you. I think being unavailable, Toby's going to actually become a one-woman man, and he's not going to be able to have her, because she's not actually interested in any of that. So maybe she's the one that will break the curse of the Fair Brothers. Maybe they'll sod off into the sunset and never bother the Archer family again.
So, Jake, I'm absolutely with you on that, and I think that's where it is at the moment. And that's the bit about Pip that I really like at the moment. She is saying, no, it's not a relationship. I don't want him as a boyfriend. You know, friends with benefits. And I'm just going to have a summer fling. And that's fine. And it is digging into Toby. He followed her down to the pub on Monday night at the birthday party and was hanging around. He was being the clingy one, so she is setting the pace. But then the worry is that actually Pip, eventually, she is quite old-fashioned, that she switches back and forgets all this.
I don't know how old-fashioned Pip is when it comes to sexual mores. I think she's actually a woman of the noughties. That would make her somewhat old-fashioned, be 10 years ago. A woman of 2016. Claire from Clapham hears certain echoes in this Pip and Toby storyline.
Hi, Royfield, and whoever's doing Dumpty Dum this week, and all Dumpty Dummers. It's Claire from Clapham here. A whole host of things that I wanted to say this week, and it's only Wednesday. Just loved Joe checking the privilege of Caroline the other day, saying, it must be so hard owning this enormous farm and a Moigby hotel. I just thought that was brilliant. Well done, scriptwriters. Loved it. Just in response to last week's Dumpty Dum on Pip and Toby, I think Toby might fall for Pip, but Pip will just back off because she said, well, she'll say it was just only ever about the sex. I'm hoping that's what's happened. I don't think Pip will fall for Toby, or at least I certainly hope she doesn't. In a way, we have kind of had that storyline too, because it was a bit like when Jazza fell for Fallon really hard and then she said, you know what, I'm not really that interested. So there's a kind of, the wide boy who's always on the pull, wants to settle down with a special girl. It didn't work out. So I think maybe we might see something a bit like that. So well done, everyone. Keep the show on the road. It's been brilliant and look forward to hearing the next episode. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yokel Bear, what do you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely on the money with Jed. What Jed said before was that I think that, the thing with Jill is that ever since they've arrived in the village, she's been like a haunted woman. You know, she's got that haunted look in her eye and she's always startled about anything to do with the Fair Brothers. Mm. But I think what's going to happen is exactly that. I think Pip, and I'm not a big fan of Pip, but I think she's taken it as she's already said it, which is that basically, this is just some fling. That's it. I'm just having a bit of fun. And she will dump him. I think that's the thing that will happen. She'll back off, basically. She'll just back off. She'll be just like, no, I've had my fun. That's it. I'm done. And I think that's when you're going to get the real confrontation between Rex and Toby, because Rex is either going to find out or she's going to make a move on Rex.
I'm not sure about the last bit. Rex will find out. It's interesting with Claire's point about the echoes with Fallon and Jazza, because there is that parallel. He pursued her for ages, and she sort of kept pushing him away. I'd forgotten all about that until I listened to Claire's call.
Fallon did relent once with Jazza. They did have one night together in the camper van or something or another, as they're off on the way to some festival or at some festival, as I seem to remember. But yes, this one will definitely run and run and run. Moving swiftly on, here's a touch of Andrea Melling, all the way from Texas.
Hi, this is Andrea from Texas. Two Dogs Molly Fleur on Twitter, but that's now out of date as I have three dogs. I just haven't got around to changing my Twitter name. I'm a dog sitter and dog walker and also a football referee here in Texas. I just wanted to comment on Tuesday's episode. I haven't been listening recently because I can't bear to hear Rob get everything his own way, but I saw on Facebook that things are beginning to turn, so I had to listen to the episode. And I had really two points. The first was, when did George Grundy turn into a public school boy? I was shocked to hear his voice. Completely unrealistic that Emma and Ed would produce such a posh child. But I also was wondering whether this means that as he's now a public school boy, that he can't be the thief from the church, as many of us have suspected. Does this clear him? Because in the Archer scriptwriter's mind, no middle-class person can be a criminal, only Grundys and Horribins and the like.
No dum-de-dum conversation about public school can start without some weighty polemic from you, Mr. Horn. So
I knew that was coming my way. Now, Andrea, when I first started listening to your call, I thought, What do you mean? If you just because he's been to public school doesn't mean he's going to be all right, because I can give you a list as long as my arm of dodgy bods that have come out of the public school system. But what you're mean? What you're meaning? You're saying in the context of the Archer's world, the Archer scriptwriter's world, the public school chaps are generally all right, and therefore he couldn't be a thief. Though, of course, we have had. Was it Cameron? Lizzie's boyfriend that knocked her around. So there is case, but generally in the village, yes, it's New George is not sounding like a proper Grundy.
No.
Oh God, I wanted to strangle him this week. Just the way he was talking to Ed like he was a moron. It's just like. Who is this character? I've not heard him speak like that before. Well, let's hope he keeps doing it and Ed gives him a backhander because he's horrible.
It's been a real week for kind of annoying kids' voices as well, because also just going back to Maeve's call, Henry's voice as well, just really grates on me. Now George is grating on me. I read somewhere that Henry isn't in the studio. They record it separately.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have this theory because Henry sounds so disjointed. It's like, you know, when you're at a railway station and they make an announcement, but it's not actually somebody make an announcement. What they've got is some actor to just read a series of words, and then they've got a machine that just puts it in order and makes the announcement.
That's harsh, Yokel Bear. That's a lot harsh.
My huge apologies to the child actor that plays Henry, but sometimes that's how it feels. I think sometimes you can tell that it's not kind of like a conversation. It's filling in afterwards because it's just a bit disjointed. But
I actually think the Henry bits are better than they were 6 months ago. And that could be because the actor is 6 months older or because they've been stung. The scriptwriter, the director, sorry, it's not the scriptwriter's job now. The director has been stung by criticism of Henry sounding so obviously not in the same room as the actors. I actually think he sounds better. I'm not saying he's particularly that convincing, but he's not as bad as he was 6-9 months ago.
I'm not sure, Royfield. I think we're just getting more immune
Used to it.
Yeah. I mean, he is, his birthday is, I think, is it January? He'll be 6. So he's certainly well past 5, and again my little boy Alex is just 7, and occasionally he can put on a baby voice, you know, for effect, but it just doesn't. He needs to be older.
Mm. Yeah,
it's not right.
If I hear him say pizza pizza one more time.
It's the all white daddy.
Oh
yes, okay, fair play. You are right, Mr. Horn. I'm just getting used to it. Going from one of the youngest residents of Ambridge to Morgan Johnson talking about one of the oldest.
Hi, it's Morgan in New York, Morgan NYNY on Twitter. I just had a little plot prediction that popped into my head. I'm sure I'm not alone in worrying about Joe Grundy. There are hints about him feeling worse and worse. I think it might not be long before he goes to the elf world in the sky.
Joe booking his one-way ticket. I'm going to break with the program convention. Jed, over to you. What do you reckon?
I'll be heartbroken when Joe goes. And his doom and gloom is... I think it's gone past funny now. It's getting really quite depressing. It's all these harbingers of doom. And, yeah, who was it that predicted earlier that he's going to live his last days out in Grange Farm? Because the way it's going, I think you're right. Yeah, or are you right, Royfield? How do we keep him going until the actor himself pops his clogs? I'm not sure how this is going to go.
I think this is Archer's convention, that old beloved characters only truly get written out when they die in real life. So I'm telling you, right here and now, Joe Grundy is not going to pop his clogs. If it happens... You know what, I will duly say I was completely and utterly wrong, but he's not going anywhere until that poor actor actually, you know, shuffles off this mortal coil in real life.
Oh, does that mean we get even more amusing and completely mental
Elfworld storylines.
Elfworld and lots of doom and the walking trees having their revenge. Oh, it's going to get bizarre, isn't
it? Well, I must admit, I love the walking trees having their revenge, but I just... And I, you know, again, I'm just repeating myself. I can't stand all this. The Grundys are just feckless and just somewhat stupid and harebrained. All this elf world stuff and Grundy world of Christmas, I can well do without. And as somebody said somewhere, you know, where the hell is Eddie finding all the time to do elf world with his handyman jobs, etc., etc.? It makes no goddamn sense.
Cards on the table about Joe, though. I see Joe as a role model for myself. Ooh. I want to be like Joe Grundy. When I'm that age, if I get to that age...
You want your own donkey?
I just love... Because, I mean, I love things like ghost stories and a bit of dark folklore and all that kind of stuff. You know, perhaps it's just a West Country thing. But I really want to be like Joe when I'm older. I want to be sat there going, oh, I don't know about that, or there's a ghost there and stuff like that. I find him fascinating, lovely, brilliant. But also as well, the thing about the Grundys is I do get really... I get hacked off with this whole idea that they're feckless because I think it's a class thing. I think some of the other people in the village that look at them go, it's the Grundys. But actually what they're saying is oh, look, it's the working class people. Mm. And actually, I think the Grundy storylines, you know, they resonate more with me than, say, something about Brian or Shula or whatever. It's like those stories seem more real to me because I think, you know, I've experienced, yeah, my family, you know, it's just kind of, you know, it just seems more real. People trying to get by. That's what it is. They're trying to get by. And this whole thing about Grange Farm, I'm going to go on to a bit of a left-wing rant here.
Ooh, okay. Normally that's my preserve on this podcast, but you can don my mantle. Go.
What really, really hacks me off, and I think it's great that they've brought this storyline in about Grange Farm, because what you've got is you've got landowners coming in and basically saying, oh, well, look, we're going to have to get shot of this property. Well, I know you're living here and I know we did you a favour, but we're going to have to get shot of it. You're going to have to leave because we want the place in Tuscany. And actually, what this is really about is the fact that there is a massive housing crisis for working class people in rural areas. We can't afford to buy in the villages. That whole thing about Emma and Ed saying, Ed, yeah. Look, we're going to have to move miles and miles away, which is going to cause all kinds of problems. So when I see that, when I hear this story, I don't go, oh, isn't it lovely? You know, Caroline and you can get the nice place in Tuscany. I'm actually with the Grundys and thinking, for Christ's sakes, Caroline, these people ain't got nowhere to go.
You know what, local bit, I'm for the most part with you. Right. However, the Grundys, or at least the male Grundys, because Clary and Emma were looking after the place, should have taken better care of it. It would have made much more medium to long term sense for them to look after that place like they've never looked after any place before. So when Caroline and Oliver came back, the place is pristine and they haven't got their backs up. You know, so I actually agree with you about the wider socio-economic reasons for them being generally the way that they're kind of displayed on the programme. There is a lack of not just rural housing within the UK full stop, and that disproportionately affects people on lower incomes, working class people, etc., etc., who now are being forced never to be able to afford somewhere but have to go into rented property, etc., etc. And dare I say, is now starting to affect middle class people, whereas now your average 30-year-old now can, who's got a decent job wherever they live in the UK, cannot afford to buy a house without some massive loan from the bank of mum and dad. So there's all of that going on. But looking at this in terms of the way the Grundys, I would say, should have, i.e. this is our emotional home. It doesn't matter who actually owns it. This is Grundy land, right?
Yeah.
And they got the opportunity to go back. I wouldn't have been cavalier with it. And they were somewhat cavalier with, you know, getting moving the pigs in and X and Y and Z. I'd have been the squeaky clean tenant myself. Yeah. But anyway,
I guess
in their view, it's a farm, and I know for the last 10 years or however long Caroline and Oliver have had it, the land has been farmed by Ed, but all the buildings around the house aren't a farm. They move back in, and they're back into decades, and, you know, but to what Yoko Bear was saying, it's their farm in that respect, and they want to put the farm buildings to use. They want to bring animals in, and I understand that, but they also always knew it was only for 6 months.
Exactly,
so it is a difficult one. I think he's going to die there, and I know Royfield. There is this convention that they let them die, and then 6 months later they either replace them or this time round with Joe they'll write him out. But I actually think this time they will, and that's why I said when Scruff died he was but the first.
Right, on that maudlin note about poor Scruff, we're going to move to Christina from Auckland.
Hi everyone, this is Christina from Hampshire, originally from North Devon. I'm a first time caller in. I run a web development business, and although I've always listened to the Archers, as my mum is a huge fan, I only really started listening properly around the time of Kathy's rape and I think Shula's doubting the church. I've got a couple of things I wanted to say. One, we really need Charlie to come back somehow. I've no idea how exactly, but I think he's crucial to Helen's case. The stuff that happened with him and Rob, I think, would be really helpful to Helen, but I've no idea how they would get her back. Does anyone know if Clary's okay? The last we heard, Eddie was shouting up the stairs, "Clary, love, are you all right?" And we haven't heard from her since. Thank you so much for putting on such a great show. I love listening. Ta-ra for now. Bye.
Now, getting back onto the storyline that I just have too much to talk about and don't want to, does Charlie Thomas hold the key? Mr. Yokelbear, over to you, sir.
Has to be you, Yokelbear.
I think they should bring Charlie back for obvious reasons and many reasons. I think Charlie Thomas, if they do bring him back as a witness or whatever, will hold part of it. I think, to be honest with you, they're going to go more Shakespearean than that. Ooh. I think the person that's going to bring down Rob is Henry, inadvertently. He's going to say things like that, just the stuff that Henry would see as just normal. Other people are going to kind of go, well, that's not right. So I don't know. I think it's going to be interesting because they mentioned about the social services interview. But Charlie, I tell you what I'd really like Charlie to be brought back for, apart from obvious reasons, is that I'd really like this Stefan mystery to be sorted out. Because it's just hanging there, isn't it? It's just, is he in a culvert? Is he in Poland? You know, it's I'd like that to happen. But on a personal level, yes, please bring Charlie back.
Mr. Horn.
Well, I think we have on the culvert gate, you're right, that needs to be sorted out. And the water issues are not going away. I know they are partly around the tree at the moment, they're cutting down the big willow tree. But as was referenced this week, there are other cases further afield on Grange Farm and also in Brookfield with that track that suddenly subsided. So water will play a key. And I hope that we've got two outcomes to the story that won't be named and the collapse of the case. One will be that Rob finally loses it and the veneer cracks, and I know Steve Steve mentions that in his call, and we've also talked about it earlier. But the other is that the waters, they are arising, and it flushes out there's some sort of big storm and it flushes out Stefan's body, and that Rob is arrested for murder just as it comes to trial. And I know it's a bit far-fetched, and I would be annoyed if that were the case, because it's not Archers for me. I'm clutching at straws to find a way to get Helen out at the moment.
Do you think that Rob's a murderer, though? Do you think he's capable of it?
I think he's capable of it, but I don't think he is. I think Stefan's back in Poland. But there is there has got to be something to do with this whole water and him blocking up the culvert. And, you know, and David knows that he blocked up the culvert. At least David highly suspects that he did. And you know what? I'm just so tired. And again, they had this brilliant storyline played to near perfection. All this other nonsense we just don't need. And we need it to be brought to some kind of speedy resolution, because it is this kind of looming presence over the whole of the village. And it's one thing to say, right, we're going to play this out in real time, because this is how it would happen in real life. But these kind of coercive control things go on for years and decades. Look at Ursula and her hubby. You know, so just bring this to a speedy end, please. And there's somebody else who wants it all to stop, and that's Dusty Substances.
Hello, it's Dusty Substances here, the wrong sort of listener. Came back from 2 weeks in Scotland, which was very lovely, apart from the torrential rain and the gale force winds and the lack of Radio 4. Wasn't able to tune in. So as a result, yesterday I listened to 2 weeks' worth of The Archers, and all I can say is please, can they stop it now? I don't want to hear any more hours and hours and hours of Helen saying no, she can't possibly say anything. And it's now got Jess saying no, she couldn't say anything either. This isn't really very engaging. Could we just either not hear them say it, or could they just get the hell on with it? Because it's really, really tedious. But could they please stop this bloody thing now? It's just driving me round the bend. And what a good thing it is that I don't normally listen to the omnibus. It's just too much to hear it in one fell swoop. Swell foop. Whichever that is, all at once, just too much. Good luck, boys. I think it's Boys Week, so I'm looking forward to hearing that. Anyway, thanks very much, and sorry to be a bit whingy again, but just hope it all stops soon. Anyway, bye-bye.
Well, no one's answering that, because I just think, Dusty, you put it so well.
Hello, Dumpty Dum. It's Steve here, speaking from the rather hot Greek island of Rhodes, in a place called Lindos, drinking some rather insipid piss called Mythos. But never mind, we'll gloss over that. The case is going to be all-consuming, isn't it, for the next few weeks? And there's going to be loads of barroom lawyers voicing their opinion, so I'll give you a couple of mine. If Anna had any nounce about her, she would be looking at the call logs and the mobile positioning of Rob's phone, because he's obviously interfering with witnesses going to see with Jess, or potential witnesses. So if she actually got an order to look at Rob's mobile phone log, they would know that he'd been visiting Jess on the eve of the trial. The other points, Shule has been blown out of the water, which is good. And I think the same is going to happen with sort of Ian's evidence as well. Well, evidence of what it is. It's basically a bit of hearsay. The prosecution are going to say that Ian's character reference is so worthless because, A, he's a near relative by way of marriage, and B, because he hates Rob because of the kissgate with Charlie at New Year. Neil is probably the only credible character witness that they've got. The rest is really just Helen's word against his. I honestly think Helen is doomed. Rob's got the sewn up. The only thing I can think of is that he's getting so irate with Henry's minor transgressions. Mind you, I would. I can't stand Henry, but that's a different story. But he's getting so frustrated with Henry. It's going to explode and, I hate to say it, sort of do harm to the child, which will then blow his case of being the messiah figure of Ambridge out of the water. Yeah, it's going to be wall-to-wall trial from now on, and I don't know how long the judges set aside to hear the case, but I hope it's not too long. I'm sick of it already. Bye-bye, bye-bye, mwah, bye-bye, bye-bye. Love you, bye-bye, bye-bye.
Thank you, Steve. Right, now, gentlemen. This is turning into a bit of a monster of a show. So we are going to go over to some emails. And we have some emails. And folks, we love your emails, so send them in. And the first one is from Leslie Greaves.
Yes, Leslie Greaves says, only Rob can get Helen off. Everyone else's evidence only proves that he's a horrible piece of work, not that he's an abuser. It's got to come from him, so I predict he will find out Henry gave the wrong answer to the social worker, loses his rag and goes to harm Henry. Emma will be there. She'll grab Henry, run off to Bridge Farm with him, and Pat will then claw the police. Horrible.
Mm. That sounds incredibly plausible to me.
Mm. Yeah, I think that might be a way. Emma's going to be pivotal, I think.
Do you know how you could? There is one other solution. You could get Susan Carter to be a character witness for Rob. And then when she gets up and said, well, I think he's okay, everyone goes, oh, well, Helen's not guilty then. If Susan likes him, then there must be something wrong with him.
Brilliant.
Anyway.
Mr. Horn, sir.
Okay, and another email from Archer Noon, who has a plot prediction. Toby falls seriously in love with Pip. She doesn't reciprocate and eventually drops him for being too needy. Toby is heartbroken but can't confide in anyone due to his betrayal of Rex. Pip then starts a serious relationship with Rex, and Toby has to eternally watch on from the sidelines as they get married, have kids, take over the farm, while he lives in the caravan with the chickens.
I tell you, gentlemen.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We're going to come back the other side of a break with, guess what? Witherspoon standing in for Millie Bell. And then we're going to go to Steve Parrott's tweets of the last 7 days.
When you don't have a roof over your head.
Build that wall. Build that wall.
There was nothing marked classified on my emails either sent or received.
Build that wall.
I am humbled to have been chosen by the Conservative Party to become its leader.
That Britain is just a small island that no one pays attention to.
A former colony won the right to determine its own destiny.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the ocean from the perspective of the other.
Do you have a National Trust sticker on your car? Do you think you could be best friends with Kath Kidson? Do you spend hours wandering around the airport looking for an organic quinoa cafe because you refuse to go to Burger King? Then Sarah Smith Cloths offer you... Available from Sainsbury's for the Posher Washer. Proud sponsors of Dumpty Dum.
Greetings, Dumpty Dummers. It's Witherspoon and Angus Haggis here, stepping in for Millie Bell today to round up what's been going on in the forum and on Facebook. It's been quite a week on the Archers, with Voldemort arising from his slumber and the Topster and the Pipster suffering devastating disappointment. So let's get right down to business. On the forum, Ms. Bubbles and Miss Mid-City both expressed frustrations with the legal strategies of Team Anna and Helen. Ms. Bubbles remarked, "She needs to say, 'He made me pick up the knife. He put the knife to my throat. He said the only way I could leave was to kill myself, and then I saw him going for Henry.'" While Miss Mid-City replied, "I've got to the stage where it's not worth my while focusing on all the stuff that bears no resemblance to the reality of a criminal trial as I know it. This is fiction, it's dramatic license, and it's plain wrong." Under the heading Voldemort's Back, there were posts by Julie Harvey, Claire Asbury, Ibn Battura, Sarah Sari, and Alison Johnson, who wrote, "Emma has the makings of a sneaky gossip, just like her mother, but will use her powers for good, not evil. Soon the whole village will know what a two-faced, hypocritical, slimy, mean, toady, creepy psychopath he is. What a happy day that will be. We will hang out the bunting, when Harrison finds it, in Rob's shed, along with Ed's cattle and Stefan's body." As a literature-themed ending to the storyline, Kelly Schroeder created a complex conclusion to the tale. It's so complicated that I can't recount it here, except to say that Henry becomes both murderer and victim, creating a very gothic ending. Now let's turn to our Facebook page. In response to the question, "Jill knows, doesn't she?" Catherine Cavanaugh replied, "Of course she saw Toby slinking off with his jocks at half-mast in the wee small hours." While Paul Dishman offered these contradictory thoughts, "My wife reckons that Pip will break his heart by dumping him, whereas I'm going for the 'I'm late, Toby, and I'm never late' storyline." Many had opinions when we wondered whether there was a breakthrough with Helen, including Terry Gardner, who said, "Oh, I hope so. It was so lovely to see everyone snub Rob in Sunday's episode. Now this, things may be looking up." Leslie Greaves remarked, "Presumably Rob will try and sabotage the 10B holiday. Let's hope Pat and Tony finally tell him where to go." And Gordon Jackson said, "Rob will try and sabotage Ian's testimony as it will involve airing Adam's affair with Charlie. Can their marriage stand it? We ask ourselves." While we expressed disappointment in the Big Shula fizzle, there were lots of thoughts and feelings, including these two. Leslie Greaves noted that at least it did reveal Alistair as a git. And Pete Ranson predicted the following. "Emma is in a position to see something. Rob underestimates her, seeing her as an uneducated local yokel who can be easily manipulated. But it feels like she's being positioned to be a critical player. Imagine that, the Dark Lord being laid low by the Grundy Carter contingent." Tom Wilson and Maisie Jett pointed out that Jess was too scared of Rob. "I should say I was working out at the gym when I heard Rob pull the sneak attack on Jess, and my mouth literally dropped. That was indeed chilling." Kate Nichols is back to wondering whether she can listen to each episode and may have to rely on us for the summaries. On a lighter note, there were many responses to the two questions I posed in honor of the Rhythm of Rio. Who is the best dancer in Ambridge and who is the worst? Please go to the Facebook page in the forum to see what people opined. Dee Leary said, "I reckon Peggy got moves," while Judith Lawrence thought that Jazzer in his kilt doing the Highland Fling was the best. Sarah Woods Rockall thought that Burke could throw some shapes, and Martin Vandenheuvel marveled at Hazel Woolley's tap dancing ability. Claire Asbury thought that David and Alistair would make the worst dad dancers. I could see that. Both JoJo Sexy Heels and I think that Ian would make an excellent dancer because, well, most gay men are. And I'll have the final word on who the worst dancers are. 1. Shula, because as Leslie Greaves said, she's too rigid and inhibited to let herself go. And 2. Rob, because like Voldemort, he has no soul. Well, I guess I'm done, so I'll talk to you next week. And as Millie Bell would say, hooroo!
Hello, this one is from Millie Bell. It's Catherine Kavner here again. Millie, you made me roar laughing last week reading out my Facebook comment with your beautiful Australian soft pronunciation of my very Irish, your man. You pronounced your man. Which, as any Irish listener will tell you, is the funniest thing you can do. Just so you know, your man is the ubiquitous expression in Ireland for anybody you refer to, your man down the road, your man who's buried by Robin the culvert, your man who's the wife beater, your man who is the horse whisperer, etc. Lots of love. Bye.
Hi, Royfield and Dumpty Dummers everywhere. Yet another Steve here, best known, I think, by my rugby club nickname, Steve the Pirate, the origins of which are lost in the mists of time. Many thanks for letting me pick my tweets of the week. The return of the Dark Lord storyline to front stage could have limited the inspiration for the more frivolous tweets, but as ever, the Twitters haven't failed to come through. The raising and lowering of Tower Bridge was, to be fair, an own goal, with Lisa Marks, Mrs. Trellis and John Reed all scoring spectacularly. Lisa in particular speaking for us all when tweeting that she will never look at Tower Bridge in the same way again. Thanks for that, scriptwriters. People also seem to think that Toby having to shoot off was worthy of comment. I really cannot think why. This week, the sainted Shula attracted much vitriol from the Twitters, so it was good to see Ancient Modern tweet, "I quite like Shula." Well, so do I, and have done so for the 35 years I've been a listener. I did, however, enjoy the birthday present of a sat-nav from the vet. Much tweeting about that, with my prize going to Dr. Plinius, who got in first with this one. A sat-nav, Shula? Does it also come with a moral compass? Inevitably, though, the whole week revolved around Tichinob. This inspired my favourite line of the week, also noticed by Albie Star and Lisa Harlow Hello, which was actually from the continuity announcer on, I think, Wednesday, when he stated, "I'm dressing up as Rob at Halloween." And thank you to Claire Bogard for this gem. Rob asks where his character witnesses are, and the whole of Twitter puts their hands up. The interview with Kafkas is going to be interesting, with Rob having put his coaching hat on. I dearly hope that Jim Easterbrook's prediction of Henry's answers comes true when he tweeted, "The right answers? Daddy gives me lots of sweets. Daddy gives me pizza. Daddy thinks chaps are better off without women." And so to tweet of the week, with a pause for the fanfare. Thank you, John from Soho, who imagined this scene. Rob is at this cottage and the phone rings. Rob. "Hello, Rob Titchener." Caller. "Have you had an accident that wasn't your fault?" Rob. "That's what I've been telling everybody." That's it. Thanks again, and goodbye from Steve the Pirate, also known as @Steve_Parrot.
Thank you for that, Witherspoon and Steve. Great tweets. Now, it's time for me to wrap the show up. Oh, crumbs. You know what? I've enjoyed this show, gentlemen. We should at least do this once a year, I reckon. Have a little bit of a manning.
It should be, there should be the Dum De Dum Sweat Lodge, really, shouldn't there?
I like that, Terry.
With cider.
Now, folks, if you've got any other great ideas of what we should do on this show, you can go to dumdedum.com, because we've got a forum on there and it's awesome. You go to dumdedum.com/forum, go put your ideas down there. Also, on dumdedum.com, we've got a shop. Oh, yes, I kid ye not. You can go and buy your Dumpty Dum mugs, T-shirts, and all manner of swag that has Dumpty Dum written all over it. Now, as important as all that is, writing an iTunes review is even more important. And this week we have three new reviews.
From The Colony That Got Away, Morgan NYMY says, "Still here, lol. Yes, Morgan NYMY was still here at the end." And
Love Radio says, "When 15 minutes a day just doesn't cut it and you need a further Archer's fix, Dum De Dum is worth listening for Lucy Freeman's hilarious A Week in Ambridge Alone. Listening makes the housework go quicker." From Brexit Britain,
we've also got Jess from Brum. "I love this podcast. Cracking stuff. Love Royfield and Lucy. Love the calls. Love the chat. And love the Elderflower Cordial Index. Thank you." Do you know, I had a moment there where I thought it was Jess from Hampshire.
If you would like to help keep our little show on the road in a financial sense, now, there are two ways this can be done. You can donate by hitting the donate button on our website, or
You can go to patreon.com, search for Dumpty Dum, and you can donate $2 a show, which is about £1.30.
It's about £1.50 now, and I really need to update that. Now, is it? Yes, remember, this show is nothing without you. So you need to get in contact. You can send us a voice message via SpeakPipe on our site, or you call us on 0203031 3105 to leave us a telephonic message from your phone if your computer's up the fritz. On social media, you can find us specifically Twitter, where we're at DumDeeDum. Me, I'm at Royfield, which is spelled R-O-I-F-I-E-L-D.
I'm at Yokelbear. Sarah Smith at Sarah_Smith. And Harriet, who's at Shambridges.
And I'm Andrew Horn at Andrew Horn UK.
And I'm at Tucker's Patch. See what I did there? Tucker's Patch.
Oh, it's very good. That's very good. And of course, don't forget, it's Lucy at Lucy V. Freeman on the Twitters. On the Book of Face, where we have 1,300 liker lurkers. Quite simply, you go out to Facebook, if that's your thing, you type in Dum De Dum, you bump into us, you sign up. It's awesome. Millie Bell corrals everybody there, and she does a cracking job. Gentlemen, 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 next year, meet you all down at the Sweat Lodge, the Cider Club, and we'll do this all again. What do you reckon?
Yay!
Great.
God bless you, lads.
Listen, I really appreciate you coming on to do this. You've given us gravitas, sir. Gravitas.
Yeah, right. I was having chats with Charlotte today, Martin, because she was doing things about Shula screaming that I'm going to go to jail. And I said, I'm going to get my Free the Ambridge 1 badge out and change it to Free the Ambridge Guilt Ridden. That's going to be the next one, isn't it? Yeah.
Mate, listen, when I get back to the UK, which is probably going to be in about a month or so, I'm going to hunt you down, Mr. Malloy, and buy you that drink I've been threatening to for some time.
Definitely. Must do. Okay, right.
All right, mate. You take
cheers,
care.
Cheers, Andrew. All the very best.
All right, cheers.
Take care.
Yeah, bye.
See you all.
Oof, that has been a show and a half. Now we've actually stopped recording, we can say what we really think. Jed, how was it for you?
Oh, that was nerve-wracking, but it was quite fun. There is a point I wanted to come back to you, which ties in with quite a bit of things. When you were talking about there's nowhere to live in the country, sort of, there's no affordable housing. Mm. I'm in a village that may as well be Ambridge. We've got three farms, a community-run village shop and a pub and a cricket team that is struggling because people can live here while they're with their parents. They go to uni, then we get them back for the cricket team when they're on break from uni, but after they've left uni, they can't afford to move back here.
Nah, that's it.
That's it. It's hollowed out. We used to have loads of social housing, according to, well, the bloke we refer to as the mayor of the village, who's just one of the elder statesmen, this big silverback gorilla that wanders around. And he said there was loads of social housing in the village, but with right to buy, that disappeared.
Jed, just so we know, so we have a proper picture of where you're talking about, where is your village? Where are you?
I'm right next to the second greatest thing to come out of Swindon, apart from Yokel Bear, the A420. Just outside Oxford, and it really is. It's proper Archer's territory. We've got the river at the end of the lane and farms and various people. But there's so many people that I look at and go, yeah, you're a Grundy. Yeah. Oh, you're Hazel Woolley. Yeah. It's great. It's very, very tough to afford to live here. And if you're going to move into this village, you need to be part of a professional couple these days. And a professional couple, you're going to see each other at weekends, so you're not going to take your Sunday off to play cricket. Taking it all back to the cricket thing again. Yeah, the Archers does ring true in a lot of ways, but there's never any new blood. It just seems to be a roundabout of people shifting around the houses, and you've all got to know each other, because there's never any new blood coming to the village.
Mr. Horn.
I've really enjoyed today. I always enjoy driving. It's been quite a while since I've been leashed on this side of the mic. And I think we should, as Terry said, we should do these. And I think Lucy should have a chance to host a show with Shambridges, Goddess Diva, maybe Maeve or Catherine, a few others. Jojo, get a few other views going as well.
That to me sounds like a wonderful and sensible idea, Mr. Yokel Bear.
Well, a couple of things.
You know what? I've enjoyed working with you. You know, many a podcast, I gently berate you, say that where you come from is a bit of a hole, you know. But actually, I do love you, really.
Oh, I love you too, Royfield.
Oh, thank you.
I've got a couple of things to say. First of all, on the having a women's hour, I've already got a bet on with Goddess Diva that if she's on, that she can't go the whole show without swearing. And if she and you've got to promise
safe
me,
bet. Roy,
you're not going to edit it so she doesn't. I said, I will buy her dinner if she manages to get through the show without swearing. But second
your
thing
money
is
safe.
Yeah, I know. The second thing is I struggled really hard at the beginning of the podcast today to not just totally fanboy Terry, because not only is he Mike Tucker, but because I'm a huge nerd, he was, of course, Davros in Doctor Who, and I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, and he's also one of the main stars of a series, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, called The Scarifiers.
Yes.
And it's like a kind of very gentle Mickey take of kind of things like Dennis Wheatley novels and stuff like that. And it's hilarious. And he's absolutely brilliant on it. And what I didn't want to do was come on and just go, oh, God, Terry, you're great. But I was at the beginning. It was just like, oh, my God, I'm talking to Terry. So, yeah. So there you go. That's my nerd fanboy thing, you see.
Now, we have a lurker in our midst, don't we?
We do.
How's it been for you?
It's been absolutely brilliant. It's been fascinating. Two things, I guess. First, I realise now how little I know about the Archers. You guys, I mean, I listen to it as a bit of relaxation. You guys just can analyse it. It's fantastic. So I really enjoyed that. If you really want to know what I know, what I think about it, you just have to look at my tweets, because I deal in keyboard stuff. I'm a keyboard warrior. I don't talk very much, but I do tweet quite a lot.
Gentlemen, this has all been wonderful. But now I'm going to go enjoy some Californian sun.
Don't enjoy.
Listen, thanks for Man's Hour, or Man's 1 hour, and by the time we've edited this, about 50 minutes. And we'll see you all again in 7 days' time on another Dumdy Dump, when I'll be back in the clutches of one Lucy V. Freeman. Toodaloo.
Yay.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hi.
Oh, that was excellent. Well done. Well done, everybody.
Thanks.
Brilliant. Cheers. We'll do this all again sometime soon. And that's that. Doodaloo.
All right.
Bye-bye.
See you soon. Bye.